Daniel came into my awareness most forcefully somewhere around 1985 when he was shipwrecked on Lake Michigan and was teaching at the Cranbrook Academy for the Arts. The work of Liebeskind's Cranbrook Studio comprised hauntingly complex, mechanically precise, handcrafted machines for the making of architectural combinations, reading machines, writing machines, and spatially vexing famous drawings known as the Chamberworks. He was known as a teacher of teachers. And after he left Cranbrook for Milan, he founded not an architecture office, but a school, a contemporary discursive society of select students whose work hovered between practice and academia. The school was called appropriately Architecture Intermundium, a space between worlds. The worlds between which Daniel was operating were that of convention and speculation. And from this school came astonishing experiments, projects that stretched the conventions of architectural conception and representation to the limit of legibility. Also out of Milan in 1989 came the competition project for the Jewish Museum in Berlin, a proposal that burst into the architectural scene like a new species of architecture, spatially and materially almost impossible to assimilate into known architectural typologies. The Jewish Museum was a Herculean effort, not just architecturally, but also politically, and a massive creative accomplishment. During its first 2 years, over 350,000 visitors toured the museum, and that was before the first exhibit was even installed. In 2007, Studio Liebeskind returned to the same site to add an additional element to the museum ensemble, a glass and steel sukkah enclosing the courtyard, creating one of the most profound museal complexes worldwide. The trajectory during and following the Berlin years is nothing other than breathtaking. Daniel's intellectual and creative output assumed many scales, diverse geographies, and encompassed every conceivable program. From the stage set to Messiaen's St. Francis of Assisi performed at the Deutsche Oper in 2002, to the mammoth 30 million square foot master plan for the Yongsan International Business Center in South Seoul, awarded just a few months ago, from a collaboration with the piano maker Schimmel to the 2008 West Side Complex in Bern, which is the largest shopping cum leisure center in Europe. Most famously, Studio Liebeskind won the World Trade Center Master Plan competition in 2003, which, despite fits and starts, is now under construction. Daniel's list of awards is exhausting to contemplate, let alone recite. Let me give you a very selective annualized sampling. 2000, the Goethe Prize. 2001, the Hiroshima Prize for contributions to peace. 2002, an honorary doctorate at Edinburgh University. 2003, named Royal Academician of the Royal Academy of Arts in London. 2004, first cultural ambassador for architecture by the United States Department of State. 2005, Giant of Design Award. 2006, Reba International Architecture Award. 2007, the Trebia European Award Laureate. 2008, receives both the AIA Honor Award and the AIA New York Chapter President's Award, just to name a few. Daniel Liebeskind has lectured at every conceivable institution worldwide. He has published widely. He has adorned the cover of Time and Newsweek magazine and was celebrated above the fold in the Wall Street Journal. He has held distinguished professorships internationally, surely none more notable than the renowned Arthur Gensler Visiting Critic Professorship at this institution and this semester. In closing, and I do want to close, I need to explain the image on the slide. I'm sure it is a surprise to Daniel. It's not part of his lecture.
I know.
It is an illustration of Vitruvius's 10 books of architecture. In book 6, Vitruvius writes of the Greek philosopher Aristippus, student of Socrates, who was shipwrecked, like Daniel, off the shores of Rhodes. The philosopher manages to pull himself ashore and there discovers, drawn in the wet sand, traces of geometric figures. The figures were in fact drawings from the first book of Euclid's Elements, the foundation of geometry and of architectural figuration, the basic tool for mapping number onto space and form, and the sibboleth of learned discourse. "Let us be of good cheer," says the philosopher, for I see traces of man! And he immediately then heads for the local gymnasium to teach and discuss philosophy with the students. This is Daniel Libeskind's business card. I don't know if you see a similarity, but if you look at the bottom of each image, you will see a faint semblance. So with that thought, please help me welcome philosopher, teacher, geometrician, humanist, architect, Daniel Libeskind.
Thank you. Thanks. That's a wonderful introduction. Thanks so much.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Am I supposed to put this on? Yes. Is this correct? Thank you so much, Kent. It's such a wonderful introduction. I'm humbled because, you know, when I hear of awards, I think maybe I'm doing something really wrong. Maybe I've sort of drifted into another wilderness of recognition. But you'll have to pardon me, you know, because just the last place I stepped on Earth, there was just some hours ago, I came from the desert. I was actually in Abu Dhabi. And I came and I stepped out at Kennedy Airport. I was picked up by a car. I washed myself. And then I stepped here to Cornell. So a very strange, interesting way to arrive from the desert to the beautiful campus of Cornell, to friends and of course, students and people who really are passionate about architecture. Let me just say that there is always a connection between the desert and architecture, because in some way, architecture is always in the desert looking for water. And we live in a time where global warming, water supplies are low, and population is growing, and cities are under pressure since by, you know, in 20 years from now, 30 years from now, most of the, you know, 60, 70% of the world's population will be living in cities. So anyway, a few thoughts, and the fact that truly, I would like to share with you just a few thoughts about architecture, because I certainly didn't approach architecture in a kind of normal way. I did work for a few days in offices here and there, but and I worked for very distinguished architects for 7 days, for 3 days. But I always found offices a little bit frustrating, boring, because you always have to kind of execute work, and execute, I mean, kill it by implementing it. So I tried to do another route to try to, you know, create kind of an atmosphere and a way to do architecture that might be slightly different in the way people work and the way we collaborate. And I think that certainly one needs several different things to do architecture. You need certainly concentration, you need consistency, but you also need the cooperative spirit. I think those are probably three also maxims from Hindu philosophy and from other wisdoms. So let me just share with you here my thought that architecture is a language. Now, that's kind of obvious. But what kind of a language is it? It's certainly not reducible to a formalistic system, as people have tried over and over again from the 18th century on to the work of formalists in New York and beyond. And we know that yesterday died Levi-Strauss, one of the founders of structuralist anthropology. So we understand something about, but I think architecture is really not reducible to that kind of language. It's really a kind of Babelian language because, and I had the good chance because I was in Abu Dhabi at a conference, it was called Conference of Thinkers, where there are about 35 Nobel Prize winners and some other people. I was lucky to be invited. And we sat at different tables trying to discuss world issues. And it was very interesting to see that, you know, I sat with, you know, Gross, the physicist who just won the Nobel Prize for particle physics, and other famous chemists from Germany just won Nobel Prize for materials research. What is the language? How do we, and we had to talk about topics of interest, you know, development of cities, what happens to capital or to capitalism, what is happening in the world today. In any way, the language is more Babelian because we don't have just a unified language. So that's part of, that was from Poland. I was just also in Poland. A few pictures from Poland. That's where I come from. These are some of the words, which are not really words, the things that I'm interested in. They're maybe symbols. They are not really just words. There are things I'm interested in when it comes to architecture. What are my interests in architecture? What is important to me when I think of buildings or places, or even if I don't think of buildings, if I think what the future might entail? So just a few things that I'm passionate about, interested in, and a kind of a palimpsest of ideas. And I put this in a kind of dialectic way or oppositional way, because I think architecture is certainly the optimist profession. You know, you can be pessimist as a general, as a politician, as a president, as a composer, as a poet, as an economist, as a population expert. But you cannot be a pessimist as an architect, because architecture is always dealing with building a better future. And that's my first experience, because my first building was the Jewish Museum. And what was it about? It was not about a building, really. Building was just a means. But how do you bring back the idea of what happened to Europe? What happened to out of Berlin? The eradication of a people, eradication of culture, the Holocaust, extermination, barbarity that we haven't seen in many centuries, and how to deal with it. You know, so you know, it's not just about the past that can never be unmade, because you can never go back to the past, but how is hope to be featured in architecture? And of course, without hope, without that, say, let's say, optimistic, and that's, it has been cheapened a lot by media, the idea of optimism, but how do you transcribe a history that is futile, fatal, disastrous, and at the same time carve into the space of the soul something that is of importance? And of course, I created a structure, a building that had to be a building for exhibits, but also to tell a story, of the disjunction of how the past and the future are interconnected through a present that is also always vulnerable, and how to create a kind of penetration into the human soul, because it's not just about communicating the obvious. Since architecture cannot communicate verbally, it cannot use words, it has to do it with very limited means. And limited like light. I mean, light is not limited, but it's hard to use light because light is using us. So that sharp tip, for example, in this structure, which I discovered that, you know, the penetration or the sharpness of light can be as wounding as a knife to the heart. And that even nature, the garden, can have a different capacity if we think about it in contemporary terms and connecting it to the history of Berlin, which is, of course, a new city after these events. And of course, we go to these cities that have been devastated by history and have to find some Archimedean point, so to speak, to move forward, not in some cheap way, but to open up a discourse, to open up a new route. So there are different routes to the past, to dead ends like the Holocaust, to continuities across obstacles, to gardens, to the main stairs. And of course, even the notion of light in the exhibitions is not really light. It's more a record of invisible addresses, invisible echoes. And again, I used very, you know, I didn't use architectural means here. I used, I wanted to complete a piece of music, Schoenberg's Moses and Aaron, for example, and an incomplete opera, which we wrote in Berlin about, you know, why is Moses silenced? Is there God? I mean, it's a good question in the death of God. And of course, going forward into new programs of the museum and a new really picture of the city, because you don't just build a building. A building is very limited, but the optimism is how to really embody a new spirit in a city. And that's what I believe, because I love Berlin with all its complexity, with all the emotions that I have since my parents were both survivors of the Holocaust. You know, it's something about the city that even a small object like a museum can transform how you feel, how you see, and how a new generation of Germans particularly. And by the way, I'm now doing a second addition to the Jewish Museum across the street on the left. You see that building, which is a flower market. They need spaces for education. They have, you know, more and more visitors, particularly young visitors, and they need spaces for. So it's a kind of transformation of the old Blumenhalle, the flower market, into an education. Okay, radical versus conservative. That's also interesting because radical is usually discredited in architecture because you cannot be radical and be an architect, right? Since you have to be very conventional and give money, budgets, and so on. But by radical, I mean go to the roots. Go to the roots of a place. That's radicalism. Now, I showed you those pictures of myself in Poland because I was just in Poland, and I'm building a building across the street from this Palace of Culture, which was, quote, Palace of Culture. It was an oppressive building built by Stalin to oppress the Polish people. And when I grew up in Poland, that was a dark time. It was a country under communism, anti-Semitism. It was a gray place of conformity. Now Poland has rejoined the world. The shadows have fallen. The Soviet Empire is gone. And I was able to build a building that stands across. And I wanted, you know, it's one of the highest residential towers. But I wanted to kind of create a sweep. And it's not, by the way, a front. It's not an extruded tower. It's a 70-story tower, but it's not extruded. It's shaped to take new vistas of the city and, of course, create also great amenities, great, you know, new streetscape. You see the Soviet buildings of another era. So again, it's a massive building, but restoring a sense of street. It's called Złota 44. Złota is the street. It means gold street, 44. My mother's family, Hasidic family, lived just, you know, it used to be a Hasidic area in Warsaw, lived just around the corner from here. And, you know, it's so great to build something that really provides a totally different aspect, totally different view of, and of course, it is not only for the people who live there, but also how the building in the skyline of Warsaw will show that the radicalism of this skyline, which was devastated by the Germans and also by the Soviets later on, that the devastation of this skyline is not inevitable, and that once you can build something, other buildings will come in this area, and the Stalin Palace will no longer be the center. You know, you don't have to demolish it. It's a piece of history. But the Stalin Palace will no longer be the focal point of Warsaw, a place that I was taken as a child because it was the only highest building and also the most oppressive one and most visible one. So again, I think as a result of this building, which is under construction, new buildings, and that's my suggestion to the mayor and the authorities of Poland, that don't be obsessed. Just create a new skyline which will not only diminish, but put the Soviet buildings and that whole dark history into another light. Okay. Everybody likes cool buildings. We live in a time where cool buildings are appreciated, but I actually don't like cool buildings. You know, I don't like these cool, neutralized buildings that are kind of feeling cool. I like the buildings that have a built-in emotion, and a built-in emotion means that they also disturb the balance of your feelings. When I was able to build this really structure integrated with the historical structure of the old power station in San Francisco, which is an incredible city, beautiful structure. It had batteries generating electricity, you know, 100 years ago, and it was only a front, and then inside nobody ever entered. So, again, the Contemporary Jewish Museum is a conversation in the margin, so to speak, because I kept the volume, not only the facade, but also the structure. And of course, inserted a completely different symbolic structure within it. You can see that there are the letters of, in Hebrew, Pardes, Pei, Resh, Dalet, Samach, you know, which are the four interpretive levels of learning in Talmudic scholarship. It's a kind of a gateway to a different way of looking at the intertwined history of industrial architecture, which is radically cut by a new form. And the new form is a Hebrew form. It's two letters, Chet and Yud, Chai, which means to life, and it's that's the Yud with its 36 openings, 18 times two. So it has different kind of spaces, and again, I think it's what I believe a building should be. It should not be a cool building. It should be a building that radiates something beyond itself and contributes. It's in a very, very kind of amazingly tough site because there's almost no possibility to express the building, and I like it. It's in a very tense relationship. The biggest hotels, you know, the Hyatt and the Hilton and Four Seasons, and behind the walls, behind the church. But I like it because it's something that is an adventure. You don't see the building in a cool way. You emotionally discover aspects that go together and really celebrate life, the complexity of life, and what it is. Well, that sounds like a cliche, innovative, formulaic, but what does that mean? Building, for example, a very large-scale project in Singapore. It's one of the largest projects. It says, you know, I don't know, 2,000 dwelling units on Keppel Bay. How do you get out of the obvious formulas you need? Elevators, shaft, you know, economy of space, the requirements of structure, the requirements of temperature and climate, but also to create something that really is different. So on the right, in these Lego shapes, you see the previous project built on this bay, right? This modular, very sensible kind of structuralist ideas. I had the site there, and I decided, well, this is a chance to really give everybody a possibility of living with a spectacular view on Keppel Bay with six high-rise towers, create a kind of a promenade with a different, totally different, the same developer, by the way, for both. So again, when you're not trapped in the formulaic, now this kind of new gateway, this is not a distortion, by the way, that you're seeing in perspective. In section, the buildings are doubly curved. To my knowledge, it has never been done before, certainly not in any residential building, maybe in a dome. And I tell you a very funny story because this is about innovation. I proposed this in a competition. It was selected with this double curve because I wanted that tropical feeling, right, of the buildings kind of being shaped in light and tropical vegetation. Of course, after working with the developers, there's value engineering, and you know, you have to straighten some walls, and you know, okay, we can't do it. So we straightened, I had to straighten some walls, obviously. You can't build such a thing. And then suddenly, the Redevelopment Agency of Singapore, which is very enlightened, it's a kind of little city state, said, no, we have given the developers, I don't know, 50% more height than normally you know, possible. But we gave them that permission to have more density because we like the double curve. So now the developers have to build a double curve. And you know, it's a very spectacular because it really means that each unit, each floor is completely different, right? It's in a different spatial position from every other floor. It's under construction. It's, you know, it's kind of spectacular. I've been to some of those apartments because you don't have the same relationship to what is on top of you and the bottom of you, right? You're not stacked. And the structure is kind of elusive but functional. Okay, political versus evasive. Another mythology that architecture is form, it's pure form. You can, you know, don't get involved in politics. That's for politicians, that's not for architects. Think of the word politeia. It means the city. So architecture is inevitably political. It always, most of the architecture that I know is evasive. It doesn't really take a position. It's kind of neutral. You know, that's why architects could build for any dictator anywhere, because they're kind of neutral. They think the architecture supersedes the political statement, but it doesn't. I had a chance to build, win a competition for the Military History Museum in Dresden. As you know, Dresden was a devastated city in the bombings of the Allies. And there was a competition. You can see the huge armory here. It's one of the largest military museums. It was always a military museum from already the beginning of the 19th century. It was the Saxon Military Museum. It became the German Military Museum. It became the Nazi Military Museum. It was the Soviet Military Museum. It was the East German Military Museum. And now, of course, we are in a democratic Germany. So my idea was, let's not try to hide the military. Let's expose the military and the people to the city. So that's the plan. I am also renovating this huge structure, which is, you know, immense. And with a very small gesture, very big impact, to bring people through this kind of vector, which, by the way, points at the triangle in which Dresden was bombed. It was bombed within a triangle, where all the bombs use the triangle as a device to focus the bombing on the historical center of Dresden, which was one of the most beautiful cities in the world with Semper and all the great architects. So there's the museum. The museum sort of penetrates through, transforms, and gives a view of the city. And it's really a different relationship to the idea of the museum, because it has a kind of anthropological accent. Suddenly you're out of these immense exhibits of chronology. The chronology is interrupted, and you get a view of the greatest, really, panorama of conflict, which is always the city. The city is the panorama of conflict. And you can see this building as it is being sort of built. It's a kind of organ. It's a kind of Trojan horse. But which is the Trojan horse? It's not the new addition. It's the old building. So that's how I conceived it. By the way, the generals who are on the jury, this was not a jury of civilians. You know, because all the architects built behind. They thought they should build behind because the famous building protected by history. But the generals liked it because one should see the military and democracy as something very important, visible, public in front of the building, not just behind the building. Well, so it will be an interesting confrontation. And by the way, those of you who have not read the diaries of Viktor Klemperer, who was from Dresden, one of the great books of all time, his journals. Please read Viktor Klemperer's diaries to know that in these barbaric bombings of one of the most beautiful cities, there was also a kind of imminent logic, because Viktor Klemperer says the only reason he survived is because of the bombings. So it's the story that will be told in this museum. Of course, this is also a museum for the military. This is where German military comes to study war. Okay, inexpensive versus lavish. You know, I'm not an architect who's ever received lavish budgets. You know, my friends like Frank and Zaha, they are lucky because they sell themselves as people who only work for very lavish clients. I am the opposite. I work for anybody who wants something. So here it is. The Vol Center in Bar-Ilan University, a building that has a budget of actually an expensive house in Connecticut. It's $6.5 million. An auditorium for more than 1,000 people, classrooms, seminar rooms, cafe, all sorts of things. So, you know, do a building for $6.5 million, not for 10 million, not for 50, not for 20. That's not a trick. You have a big budget, big deal. You know, do a cheap building and a building that is good. So I use local, you know, I use local labor. I use local techniques. I reduced everything to sort of what was possible and created, by the way, the building stands, it's a kind of also similar. It's like a big book, which is the auditorium. It's cantilevered on top of walls. So it's like book that's crushing the walls and the walls that are supporting a book that's sinking. It's kind of that to me, education and learning. And then it has and it has also a you know, a kind of symbolic, reverse symbolic, sort of a Kabbalistic center in the building. You can see it in sections. It's pretty simple, but dramatic spatially. Of course, it's a kind of a gateway to the university, because on one side are the big housing blocks, right? On the other side, very eclectic campus. And this is actually the fastest growing university in Israel. It's religious studies, but science also. So very, very interesting. Expressive versus neutral. You know, again, I've never been a fan of neutrality in anything. I don't like neutral countries. I don't like neutral people. I don't like neutral colors. I just don't like anything neutral. And expressive. Okay, a building in Hong Kong for the Creative Media Center. You see it here. It's a gigantic building. It's really one of the largest educational buildings. It's got the sound stages, you know, large facilities for performance, for experiments, a classroom. It's really a huge a huge thing. By the way, we work on very large models. We have a lot of computers, and Eric is here, so he's one of the people who knows the computers very well. But we work with large physical models. The main stairs, for example, a big kind of exhibition and conversation space. So look at the plan. It's packed, you know, and of course, with users, groups, we have to discuss every single, you know, room and flexibility. And so it's a machine. But at the same time that it's a machine, I thought, you need a building in Hong Kong, which is such a pragmatic place where everything is kind of Bucks like, you need a building that's going to sort of try, not go beyond, because you can't go beyond ever, but will twist itself away, or which will try to torque itself away from what's around it. It's kind of like leaving metaphysics behind through a distortion. Communicative versus mute. That's another thing, because a lot of people think that mute buildings are great. You know, like a silent building. It's the myth of Louis Kahn, it's the myth of Swiss architects, the silent building. I've always thought that muteness is good for a cemetery, but not for architecture. So I believe that buildings should communicate across various borders. And I had a chance when I won this competition for Grand Canal Square in Dublin, which will open very soon, to create a plaza. I worked with Martha Schwartz on the landscape here. And it's a private public partnership. I also built some of the large office blocks behind it. But my idea was, again, it's a very economical project. You know, nobody can build anything expensive these days anyway. It's a kind of curtain, a glazed curtain that has a lobby, very compact, supported by what you see in the back, which is office buildings, which generate enough income to build this building. Here are the office buildings, very sustainable, very high-tech buildings, creating also a kind of, these are the office blocks that kind of open up a new vista towards, believe it or not, that landscape back there, it's called Misery Hill. That's Dublin. That's the old Dublin. The Docklands is going to change it. And of course, to create a spectacular, this is more than 2,000-person theater, which is underway. And you can see that this is now already a kind of a new place where, for the first time, the Kirov Ballet, you know, Bono, you know, all sorts of things will be. Harry Crosby, who's running it, is bringing already, you know, for the next year. It's been booked, you know, for 300 shows. So again, something, I love Dublin, and Dublin is a great city, and it's kind of special thing. Okay, pointed versus blunt. I think everything should have a point. Not be blunt, but have a point, which means a focus on it. And here I had a chance in the center of the City Center project by MGM Mirage in Las Vegas on the Strip. To build that connective base, you know, you've got the big hotels, casinos, and we collaborate. You know, there's the Foster, there's HOK, there is Helmut Jahn, there is Pelli, you know, many different architects. And my task was kind of the ground, which is really the public spaces, the retail spaces, all that. Kind of early sketch, kind of create something kind of spectacular that changes the idea of just moving by car. It's a kind of a recent photo. It's opening in a few days or a few weeks, December 3rd, I think. But it's a kind of a shattered space that is on the boardwalk and on that strip. And it has in the central sort of volumes the big flagship stores, Vuitton, you know, Prada, the biggest ones in the world. And creates rather a different image than the nostalgia of the old Las Vegas. And I think it, by the way, has just received the highest sustainability ratings because they use daylight, you know, do things that are, and by the way, Helmut Jahn's towers are great because they take the idea of the torque of the building and the instability of the ground of the building, create two towers that are also kind of leaning. So it's, I think, a very interesting transformation of really the typology of what such a building is. You can see it here, something very, very different in atmosphere. And of course, memory. Ultimately, I think that the judgment of architecture is not its aesthetic, it's not what architecture critics will say, it's how memorable is a building in your mind after you leave it and never see it again, perhaps. So here, and I just came from Milan as well, I was charged with developing the master plan and be one of the architects of a new area right in the middle of Milan where the fairgrounds used to be. They moved out. This is very close to the center, to the Duomo, the central tower, which is mine, to other towers, park, housing. There you can see it, to picking up, you know, the idea to pick up the scale of the city at its perimeter, then open the space at the center and create high-rise, you know, first really tall buildings in Milan. Offices, hotels, and so on. And I'm also doing the Museum of Contemporary Art. There's retail, there's historic things. So, and sketches for very high density housing. It's really high density housing, which has to accommodate you know, the standard of Milan, and I lived in Milan, is a very high standard of architecture. Also, the central tower, which I based on a kind of idea of the unfinished Leonardo Dome on the Duomo, which, of course, has to go through many iterations. It's highly political. Even Mr. Berlusconi spoke about it. So I have to work with authorities to make sure that this tower, central tower, is the appropriate, also iconic image of Milan. And, of course, the museum, which is just under in design, will be a contemporary art museum. Again, based on another Leonardo idea. He was the architect of Milan. You know, that center, the circle and the square, the inscribed figure of a man. He should have also had a woman and a child. But anyway, I took it in the kind of oblique direction. And, you know, it's a museum that has program, public programs, and sort of different kinds of spaces. Unexpected versus habitual. That's certainly true, that habit is the shackle, not for the free. It's a voluntary incarceration. So the idea of the unexpected, even when you have a very large project like this West Side project in Switzerland, which you can see it's vast, it's over a highway, it's sustainable in its materials, it has a hotel, not a 10-star hotel, not a 6 or 5, it's like 2-star hotel, it's Holiday Inn. It's my lot. I like it. And we've got the part of the program, housing for the elderly. Bring the elderly where the young people are, and within the big containers, which of course are the large containers, create something really fantastic with the public spaces, because you cannot change the logic of economy of how stores operate. That's a formula which you cannot challenge, really. But what you can do is change the image, change the public spaces spatially, not just through materials. Just to give you the complexity and the scale, it's really a city. It's not really a building. It's straddling the highway. The highway goes underneath the building. You've got spas, some of the largest ever proposed. You've got the sort of shopping. You've got multiplex cinemas, convention center, hotels, as I said. So it's an urban project. And my idea was very simple. Erase the typology. I know that Cornell, 20 years ago, was a school of typology. Everybody was studying typology. My idea is the opposite. Forget typology. So my idea was here, make a shopping center look like a museum, because it is. It's a museum where you can buy the things and change the atmosphere completely. So you can see this. I even was able to put here oblique fronts. It was a very hard argument. I didn't get 100% oblique fronts, because people say, well, you have to have a straight front for a shop, but it's not true. I got at least 30-40% oblique fronts, and a kind of dizzying space. It really is a dizzying space. And by the way, it's extremely popular, because Switzerland is a country of boxes. And now you've got, in 1 year, 4.6 million people. And this is in the middle of countryside. It's not in a city. It's on a highway. You have to take a train there. You have to go by bus or by tram. So again, I think one can create a very unexpected, non-habitual. This is the spa area, which has swimming pools, and it's more like the ancient scale of the Roman baths. It's kind of spectacular in its scale, in its views, and you can see it in this kind of suburb periphery. But it's not a periphery for long, because now it's a city. Now buildings are being built, and that was my idea. There should not be this idea of periphery. This should be treated seriously as an urban experience that is complementary to the history of the old city. Okay, simplicity has been vastly overrated, truly, because nothing is really simple. And complexity, we know from everything else that the world is complex. So the idea of simplicity in architecture has bothered me for a long time. The Dream Hub Yongsan project, which is one of the largest urban projects in the world. It's 30 million square feet. It's new infrastructure. But the idea was, bring the city to a different position. Don't just develop the grids and what was there, the same logic, and just bring trendy buildings, but create something of a different approach. I call it archipelago. Create a different sets of neighborhoods. Of course, there's thousands of buildings there and different kinds of programs, living, retail, office buildings, a new center, a new transportation hub, but create a very different planning to revive the Han River and to create not just the tallest building in the world, which might very well be there, but that's not the most important thing. It's how the complexity of that city is working in a way which is not just a tabula rasa erasure of history, but takes the railways that used to be there, takes a kind of historical view of the archipelago of Korea itself, and creates something that is going to be a new standard, I think, for development of a large urban space. That's another thing. You know, architects really usually play it safe. If you want to commission, be safe, unless you're already very famous and they let you do your forms. But I would suggest that daring is something that is really kind of truly difficult to achieve. So when I was building the Denver Art Museum, I did a number of things that have never been done. One of them is the largest cantilever in a public building. I mean, it's a cantilever that goes over a main street of Denver, and a building that comes to a true point, kind of infinite point, and a building that has totally different strategy from the Geoponte building on the right, which is more like an office building, very nice building, but, you know, very practical. But they didn't have, you know, the atrium. They didn't have the big spaces for special exhibitions. So my idea was to shape large spaces that can be flexibly used, of course, also modern contemporary Western art and so on. And it is a Western building. I love the West. I love Denver. I love the Rocky Mountains. It's got the spirit, you know. And that's the only place that I've ever been where nobody asked me, like, why are these buildings like, why is it like that? Or, you know, what is the sharp angle here for? Everybody says, wow, that's just like Denver. So, yes. And now, by the way, they are creating a completely new exhibition. There's a new director who's commissioned 15 artists, I think each one are below 30 or 25, to transform the museum completely with their works. So, and that point, by the way, you're way suspended in an infinite point in the black, going sort of way over the high rises of Denver. I was also able, by the way, to create a plaza. You know, it's not just about a standalone building, although that was the competition. I know Tom Main and Isozaki and Stephen Hall, everybody was in the competition. My idea was, okay, we have to build a garage. You don't see the garage, it's behind there for 2,000 cars or whatever. It's a city ordinance. But I suggested in the competition, why don't you close the street, create a piazza, build condominiums, create a public space in the center of the city rather than more parking. And luckily for me, there were investors who built these buildings with my designs. And by the way, that was the interesting thing to me. Usually, the apartments, the condominiums with the views of the Rockies are the most expensive and most quickly sold. In this building, it was the reverse. It was the views of the museum that were the most expensive and sold quickly. The views of the Rockies sold the last for the least money because, you know, you can see them from everywhere. It's a very bold. It's really not a museum for sissies. And I have to say that's. That's what Denver, I mean, that's the pioneering spirit which I love about America. It's like you can do anything bold, never done before, experimental, daring, and it is. And it's been embraced by Denverites, and of course it's growing as we speak. It's part of the new neighborhood with the state capitol, with the Golden Dome, and this whole neighborhood is now being transformed to a really living and sustainable versus standard, where I had a chance, this is actually not completed, to build a limited edition villa made in Germany and create a building that is very efficient in terms of energy, almost zero energy, contribute to the grid, use all sorts of materials, techniques, new techniques of circulating the water from the roofs, photovoltaics, of course, biomass, and all these things, and create really a place to live. This was built in the Rhine Zinc factory, because it's zinc, it's a new zinc cladding. So it's a kind of a guest house for, you know, guest pavilion for a company. But it is being used as a prototype for a villa. And it's, you know, it's very special. It's not huge, but the ceilings rise to more than 7 meters in height. It's not just a cluster of modules, although it is very rational, but it creates diversity of views, orientations that can be put on different sites. So, you know, it's going to be, I think, a very, very special thing. Okay, open versus closed. Well, architecture should be open in general, not closed, unless you need privacy. But in New York, at One Madison Avenue, I had a chance to design a tower, a residential tower, which is different. It's still economically the same model, but the idea is to really create every apartment should be like a penthouse, and you should be able to see through the tower in a kind of spiraling way that the tower is in it is an extrusion, but it's also open. And you can see that it's built on top of an existing building. And it's, you know, threading its way through mega columns, through existing. Nothing could be more sustainable than building on a building that is already existing. So again, that part of, you know, and it's a spectacular area of New York, as you well know. And it's got the Flatiron Building. It's got that great tower. So again, creating something, of course, that is ambitious, that also suggests a different way of treating even the formulaic high-rise building. And finally, that is the most important, I think, that democracy is not just a word, and authoritarianism is not just another word, that it makes a difference to live in a democracy. And, you know, I haven't worked in some countries because I fear that if you don't have public involvement in the process of building, even if the buildings are quote-unquote beautiful, they're going to be follies 20 years from now. So when I had a chance to work on Ground Zero, I tried to embody many things that I think are important, and symbols are important, particularly after these attacks. You know, I don't have to tell you. We all know how our lives have changed in every way, not just coming to the airport, but the world has changed after September 11th. And by the way, I was just on a BBC television interview, and the guy said, "So, Mr. Libeskind, where were you on September 11th, 2001? And I had to tell him a funny story. September 11th, 2001 was the day that the Jewish Museum opened in Berlin. And I was in Berlin, and I went to my studio that day, and I turned to Nina and Alice. I said, "You know, this is the first day I don't have to think about history. Now the doors are open. I don't have to think about history, Jewish history, German history. Now let people enter the building." The building closed its doors at 2:30 in the afternoon. It was, you know, 8:30 in the morning in New York time, because of the attacks. There was such uncertainty. So the building opened and closed on September 11th. And I thought, you know, when I was working on Ground Zero, that it's not just another site. Of course, it has millions of square feet of density. We know what it is. But what is it about? It's about shaping, giving a vision to an area that is both memory, but also foundation for a New York that is of the future, that is a New York of vitality. And here it is, my original model, with the buildings kind of spiraling to recall that torch of liberty, leaving the emptiness and nothing really at the center of the space. I would say the latest plans are very, very close. Of course, it has to go through many, many, you know, sort of test of fire to garner consensus, to think of the people who are involved in this project. You know, there's the families of the victims. There's the Port Authority, who owns the land with their architects and the investors. There's the governor of New York, now the third governor, second governor of New Jersey for the Port Authority, mayor of New York, MTA, PATH trains. It's a city. So the memorial site is certainly not built upon. That's very important. And also in my original scheme, water to screen the sound of busy streets. So that give it a spiritual sense of the site. And of course, the slurry wall and the bedrock was a very important part of my design. You know, I went down to that site. It was interesting. We were all the famous architects, you know, Foster and Zaha, and, you know, all the whole world of architects was there in the, you know, in One Liberty Plaza, looking down at the site during the competition. Really, like who's who in architecture? And then on this miserable November day, somebody from the Port Authority said, "Does anybody want to go down to the site?" And everybody said, "No, we can see it better from up here because you see the sun." Something struck us. Nina and I went to the site. It was devastating. When you walk down to this bedrock, you suddenly get close to where people perished, and you understand. And by the way, some engineer, I put my hand on this thing, and he said, "That's the slurry wall." I never heard of the word. And I said, "What is that?" And he said, "You know, you're standing with a dam. This is the dam that protects, you know, New York from being flooded by water. All the subways would have been flooded." So again, slurry wall is part of the memorial, part of the museum. The wedge of light, that's an element I introduced because I thought it was very important to have an entrance, a public entrance to the plaza. And this entrance to the plaza, which is, again, given that we have 10 million square feet of density of office buildings, 5 million square feet of other densities, infrastructure and so on, to create more public space is difficult. But about half the site, almost half the site, is open public space. It's shaped by those two lines of light, and the central line of the station is along that alignment. So it's going to be meaningful because it's a memorial in the light of New York. Of course, the Freedom Tower, very important as part of the spiral of buildings. They are all stand within the grid, but they are actually in a spiral formation. And of course, all the ongoing things that are part of the plan, you know how difficult it is to accomplish it. It's not about an architect drawing a couple of drawings and going to bed. You've got to fight for every inch. And it's a struggle. But look, this is my first drawing on the left, initial sketch. This is the latest rendering. It's pretty close, given that we are speaking about gigantic forces to shape this site. And of course, one has to do one's best. And when you come from the Bronx, as I do, you don't really give up. That's really the last image I have. You know, I came to New York as an immigrant. And I was probably lucky because I was one of the last immigrants to come by ship. Now, later on, everybody flew. It was cheaper to fly than take a ship. But I saw this skyline, you know, as a boy of 13, 14, kind of like in the movies. You know, you get up in the morning, your mother wakes you up. You get up, you stand on the deck with other immigrants, you know, wide-eyed, and you're told you're going to see the Statue of Liberty. And, you know, you've seen movies, you've had books, you know something as a teenager about New York, but there's nothing to prepare you for the power of the symbolism of the Statue of Liberty, the light of the oppressed, and the light onto the skyline of New York, which, by the way, is unfathomable. How could people have built all that? When you see it in that way from a ship as a teenager, you can't believe that it could be built, especially if you come from, you know, where I came from. So maybe we'll get a bit too used to it now, but that's what New York is. It's about liberty. It's about freedom. It's about all the things that make life worth living. Thank you. Other questions? Other questions? I was told that I have 15 minutes for, you know, maybe you can put the lights up.
Do you want to moderate?
Can we put the lights on? Okay, light, yes, everywhere, yes.
Hi, can you hear me? This is good. First of all, thank you for the lecture. You've set up the lecture by defining these oppositions, these relative terms, and there's a clear argument that you can explain your projects in relation to the landscape of, in relation to the rest of the landscape of architecture. How would you define your own work against itself using the same terms that you've broken up your lecture in?
I don't understand your question.
you've defined your lecture based in relation to other architecture. Like, for example, you've explained, you've set it up as a bold and daring and revolutionary. You've talked about your work in that sense.
Never use the word revolutionary.
Okay.
Radical.
Bold, daring, radical. But you're measuring it against other architecture. How would you measure your work against itself as it evolved using those same terms? Would you...
I still don't understand the question, but maybe what you mean to say, you know, architecture is not about itself. You know, a writer interested in... I'm not interested in writers or interested in writing. I'm interested in writers who write a story. I'm not interested in artists who are interested in art. I'm interested in artists who are interested in trees or birds or something else. I'm not interested in architecture which is interested about itself, but architecture that is interested about something else. So yes, it's not architecture for architects.
I guess I'm asking, you're saying your work is bold in relation to other
architects. No, I'm saying that's what I'm interested in. Not in relation to other things. That's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the bold. I'm interested in the innovative. I'm interested in the sustainable. It's not versus other architects. It's just a category. You have to see the tension of what that means, because every project, of course, is struggling, you know, to do those things. It's not that easy as saying the word. So maybe that's what you mean. It's kind of setting up a tension, because everyone's work is between those poles anyway. Okay. I take another question.
Hi, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I have two questions for you. First question is, what would you say is the future for deconstructivism? And the second question is, how would you rate your collaboration with Capo Land in your recent project in Singapore?
Let me start with the second question first. I really enjoy working in Singapore with Capo Corp. Fantastic company, interested in quality, very, very forward-looking. And by the way, we're working at two other sites. We've been invited to work on two other sites, you know, across Sentosa Island, which extend the importance of re-urban, you know, urbanizing that land that was kind of peripheral in that part of the city. And it's, of course, as you know, very close to the city by public transport. So again, it's a value to the city, and it's value to the growing potential of Singapore. As to your first question, you know, I'm often asked that. You know, this was a word invented really for an exhibition at the Museum Maranat by Philip Johnson, not by Mark Wigley. It was invented by Philip Johnson, and he was a very clever person, very smart. But he knew when he invented that word that it was very ambiguous, because, of course, deconstruction in literature and philosophy is a kind of postmodern philosophy, which means that the modern is finished. We are in a postmodern phase which will not produce anymore anything else except itself, sort of the lack of its own foundations. But in architecture, this doesn't have much meaning, I think, to me, because even though I was part of that exhibition, you know, with Frank Gehry and other people, architecture, it's very difficult to argue that architecture has much to do with deconstruction. It's really about construction. And even if you change the idea of architecture, you cannot really get it to kind of to be deconstructed, because it has, by the way, the difference, you know, deconstruction means there are no foundations, God is dead, there is no beginning, and therefore we are not in a consistent world of logic. Architecture is just the opposite. In architecture, there is ground, there is foundation, and more than that, there is belief, because to build anything, you gotta believe in it. I mean, somebody has to spend money, and that's the highest form of belief. We know that. So I hope I answered that about deconstruction.
The crystalline form seems to be a common theme throughout all of your architecture, and I was just wondering if there was a reason for that, and if so, what it was.
You know, Frank Lloyd Wright said that all good architecture is a crystal. He said, because every building is to be chiseled. It's, you know, it's a crystal. It doesn't matter what it is. It's truly, I don't like blobs. They are not crystals. You know, they might be made out of, you know, crystalline portions. That I like them, you know. No, you know, it's just something I like. I'm inspired by, you know. And by the way, crystals, we know that the world is crystal. It's not just in J.G. Ballard's crystal worlds that the crystal exists, but the crystal, you know, is the DNA structure. It's the cosmic structure. The world seems to be shaped in some very special way. I'm not a believer in intelligent design, but I do believe in crystals.
Hello. I wanted to, again, thank you for your presentation. It was beautiful.
Thank you.
You said you flew from Abu Dhabi. Are you building there? And if so, what will or would be your political statement?
I'm not building anything.
Okay.
As I said, I was at a conference of thinkers, which Abu Dhabi had. I find Abu Dhabi actually a fantastic, very fascinating place. As you know, it's a monarchy. women can wear, some women on the streets wear miniskirts. It's not a fundamentalist state. It's a developed, you know, of course, you know, it's very ambiguous. You know, China, you know, I admire China, and maybe I made a terrible mistake by being maybe the only architect who hasn't worked there, even though I received many invitations, because I see it changing. You know, people are beginning to be more vocal. There seems to be a kind of change underneath the ideology that is sweeping forward. So it's not black and white. It's you know, it's a personal decision. You have to make a personal decision. Where do you feel you want to be, and do you feel good about it? I actually felt very privileged to speak with Sheikh Nayan, who is the Minister of Education, about ideas, about how he thinks the country is developing. The conference itself was, to me, one of those enlightening experiences. Where else can you have Nobel Prize winners sitting at a table with architects, or with an architect, because I think there were only two of us, and discussing, you know, a future of cities or something like that. So, you know, it's an interesting, I don't have a project there right now. Sure. Yeah. Very, very, you know, the question is, first of all, the world economy. What is going to happen in the world economy, given that in 20 years, we have now 6.5 billion people in the world. In 30 years, there'll be 9 billion people, 50% more people in the world. Resources are not going to grow. They're shrinking. Natural resources, reserves are shrinking. Cities are, you know, bursting, right? You know, there is a huge pressure on cities. Population is growing older. The present population is growing very old, but there's a huge movement of young people. Young, birth rate is very high, particularly in the less developed or on the world where people don't have as much access. What will happen to water? What about climate change? What about health? What will happen to health? So these are just, I sketch out the big issues. But one of the issues that is very interesting to discuss is, why do people go to cities? Why is there such a pressure on cities? And one of the smart Nobel Prize winners said, there is only two reasons why people go to cities, for food and for sex. Yeah, and that's why the cities are, because it's easier to find food in cities, and it's easier to meet somebody, to form a relationship. Think about it. These questions must affect architects in the long run, and they are more than just about sustainable technologies. You know, we obviously sustainability is very important, and we know that, but really, it's the bigger picture. You know, what are we going to do in our limited ways? You know, everybody has their sort of their area to tackle some of these problems, and I can't go deeply into the question, but my own position was that we cannot apply Eurocentric models onto the rest of the world, because the Western philosophy in many ways failed completely. It's not a philosophy that should be spread around the world as kind of the enlightenment of the third world. So we have to be very critical of the limitations of Eurocentric thinking, and that goes together with technology. The idea of technology, which is kind of rational, objective way of thinking, and mathematics that goes with it, that sort of encompasses the global world. And the other question, I'm going a little bit off, I have a few seconds to say something. One of the things that has disappeared from the world is politics. Everything is economics. There's hardly any more politics. In every country I go and I work, whether it's Israel or Abu Dhabi or, Singapore or Korea or Poland or Ireland or Italy, there is no more politics. It's just about money. So you wonder, can the world, which is only running on a Marxist idea, because Marx is the one who established the world, the idea that economics is the foundation of the world, is this a viable idea? Don't we need politics to reconcile differences and to create a social aspect of living, since after all, we can't be just consumers and producers? And increasingly, America is a country of consumers. So those are some of the questions, some of the things that are in my mind. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.